Examining the Incentives in Educational Research by Dominic J. Brewer and Dan D. Goldhaber. In their bestseller, Freakonomics, University of Chicago economist Stephen Levitt and New York Times writer Stephen Dubner show in an amusing and often provocative manner how an economic way of thinking can be useful in explaining all sorts of real-world phenomena. Their central insight is very simple. Incentives are the cornerstone of modern life. As economists, it's no surprise that we take this proposition as the starting point in our effort to understand the educational research enterprise in the United States. By some measures, the enterprise is quite healthy. In terms of the quantity of completed research, it's booming, and barely a week goes by without a major national media outlet reporting on the latest finding of educational research. Unfortunately, the bulk of educational research neither is outcomes-oriented nor uses methods that support strong inferences about causality. Despite an emphasis on randomized research designs, for example, by the U.S. Department of Education, and on the use of sophisticated quasi-experimental methods, particularly those using comprehensive student-level longitudinal data, the proportion of the entire educational research enterprise that would pass muster for scientific rigor in other fields is shockingly small. Consequently, for policymakers striving to craft effective policies, the research base remains thin. We explore some of the reasons for this below. Failures in the market for educational research. We examine the market for educational research using a supply and demand framework. In this case, the consumers are the policymakers, educators, and parents who demand research evidence to help them make critical choices about how to allocate resources, how to teach kids, how to choose schools, and so on. The suppliers of educational research are the individuals and organizations that produce the studies, reports, and findings. Most markets in the private sector are brought into equilibrium by changes in price, the critical signal that tells consumers to demand more or less, or suppliers to produce more or less. In the case of educational research, the price might be considered the monetary value placed on any particular research study of a given quality. However, the consumers and the funders are not synonymous in educational research, and both operate in institutional settings that are political, as do many of the producers. As a result, signals that direct the flow of resources devoted to educational research, unlike most private sector markets, are decidedly murky. Anyone who desires to make an educational decision on the basis of empirical evidence, rather than intuition, casual observation, tradition, or ideology, might be considered a consumer of research. At the level of the individual student, classroom, or school site, it is educators themselves who decide what strategies to use with particular students, how students should spend their time, who teaches them, and so on. Within the bureaucratic, hierarchical, government-operated K-12 system, many decisions are made at levels above the school and involve all branches of government through political oversight. In contrast to most markets, where consumers who demand and use a product pay for it directly, consumers of K-12 public education pay for these services through general taxation, and in most cases cannot exercise the power of exit by switching providers without incurring the additional cost of private schooling. Consequently, the producers of educational research have less direct incentive to satisfy the demands of consumers because those demands are not expressed through the signal of price. Another issue that arises in the context of the market for educational research is information. markets need informed consumers to function well. Research would help to inform many education policy decisions. Yet because educational research is a scientific endeavor, its methods and analyses are often a mystery to those who consume. A decision maker seeking educational research may be unable to tell whether a study is well designed, believable, or usable. Work that is aimed at a broad audience, that has face validity, and that accords with prior beliefs as to the right answer, is likely to attract disproportionate attention. More complex and sophisticated methods may produce reliable and valid results, but they are hard to explain. While this is not unique to the field of educational research, there are no agencies or organizations within education that act as strong quality control gatekeepers, providing consumers with a trusted stamp of approval. This may explain, in part, why so many intermediaries are able to interpret and synthesize educational research in ways that suit a particular agenda. It is almost inevitable that important findings and critical nuances got lost in such translations. On the supply side, we also find important differences from traditional private sector markets. Research is produced by individuals, but individuals, with the exception of a handful who are self-employed, are nested within organizations. Here we will distinguish between two main types of organizations: universities and think tanks or other private firms. The incentives for those operating in think tanks or private sector companies are relatively straightforward, since these firms are dependent on so-called soft money that comes in the form of grants or contracts. In this environment, researchers face considerable pressure to raise funds from public and private agencies, as their salary trajectory and job security are directly related to the success of any fundraising endeavors. The upside of the research supplied by soft money institutions is that it is likely to be policy relevant because it is client-driven and generally formulated to inform a specific issue for which there is an audience. Over the long term, the work produced is likely to match the expectations of the funders in terms of quality, timeliness, relevance, and so on. If it does not, then such suppliers will find themselves with less and less work until eventually they will go out of business. Although many think tanks and private firms are highly influential as producers of research, the bulk of the research in education is generated by university-based academics. These academics conduct research in different departments, schools, and centers within universities. These departmental silos often operate semi-autonomously, with distinct norms, policies, and expectations for who gets hired and promoted, and with incentives offered for securing external funding. As a result, there is often relatively little interaction and collaboration across these boundaries. This has important implications. It reinforces the production of work that reflects a single disciplinary view of the world. It minimizes the sharing of methods and new developments, and it limits institution-wide scrutiny of the quality of research. Within the university, the main impetus for scholarly work is job tenure, which under most conditions guarantees lifetime employment for faculty members and ensures their academic freedom to write about whatever they choose. Universities differ greatly in their tenure requirements, but usually they require publishing in peer-reviewed journals. These journals differ significantly in focus and quality and are mainly read by other academics. In many cases, a premium is placed on technical sophistication rather than on policy relevance, which means that the university tenure system provides a direct incentive not for research that is useful or relevant for policymakers or practitioners, but rather for research that academics' peers will value. Furthermore, although the tenure process encourages high-quality, high-volume research, it does not directly require academics to seek external funding for that research and may discourage long-term impact studies that generate relatively few publications. Institutions certainly like receiving external research funding as a way to offset costs. However, other than at a handful of the most highly ranked research institutions, funding is not required for promotion and tenure. All of this tends to bias work in favor of less costly, qualitative case studies, which focus on process issues rather than on the efficacy of practices, programs, and policies, and which do not yield generalizable findings. How might the incentives be improved? A supply and demand framework yields important insights into the educational research enterprise and provides some clues as to how it might be made better. While we are not so naive as to think that the strong incentives governing the relevance and rigor of educational research can be changed overnight, we do believe that federal, state, and local policymakers can take steps toward improvement. Research is demanded because it is thought to be a useful tool in guiding decision makers. Of course, adequate funding is crucial to conduct research on a scale large enough and with sufficiently rigorous design to make it useful. Large-scale efficacy studies, for instance, require millions of dollars over a sustained period. Yet the federal government's research effort is split among many agencies and divided into even smaller pots of money within each agency. And each state acts largely on its own. While there are strong pressures to divvy up funds among many small projects and powerful constituencies, the exponentially greater value of consolidated efforts must be highlighted. States and localities could learn much more about the effectiveness of their policies by taking more of a lead in obtaining funding, maybe through consortia organized by region or common interest. These could be facilitated or even financially induced or subsidized by the federal government. Private sector companies might also take more of a lead in funding research and development within the education sector. Textbook publishers, for instance, have a vested interest in selling books. We would like to see incentives along the lines of the What Works Clearinghouse to make sure that the books they sell are in fact aligned with student achievement goals. It would be helpful for policymakers to encourage private interests that play key roles in the educational process to fund high-quality, independent analyses of the products and services they provide. Undoubtedly, as more private or quasi-private providers of educational services emerge, it becomes more likely that there will be non-government financed R&D. Foundations and the federal government request some demand-driven research, but a striking feature of educational research is the extent to which what gets done depends on the standards and the topics that research suppliers value. The result is a disproportionately large number of studies devoted to pedagogy, organizational culture, diversity, and so on that reflect the ideological biases of many of the university-based researchers. However, there are promising developments on this front. Some foundations actively seek to fund research that is built on school districts' priorities. For example, the Council of the Great City Schools has recently announced a fellowship funded by the Institute of Education Sciences, IES, to embed senior educational researchers in a large urban school district and have them focus on producing research that is both rigorous in nature and relevant to the specific challenges facing such districts. Perhaps the increasingly severe sanctions of NCLB and the pressures on state accountability systems will generate greater demand for good data and research that can inform decision-making. Finally, educational research needs better mechanisms of quality control to help policymakers distinguish good research from bad. Gatekeeping in educational research can and does happen on both the front and back ends. Some foundations have quite rigorous review processes, and IES reviews of research proposals are far more focused, for the better, on rigorous methodology than has been true historically of other federal efforts. The What Works Clearinghouse, the Campbell Collaborative, and initiatives of the National Academy of Education, and even the American Educational Research Association, have gradually increased the awareness of the importance of research design. At the same time, as the number of research outlets grows, it gets harder to separate the good research from the bad. This is deeply problematic, since most consumers of the work will not have the time or capacity to judge its quality. If the rigor and relevance of educational research are to be increased, we will need a concerted effort from both consumers of research and suppliers who recognize the desperate need for improvement.